We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Ladies and gentlemen, your weekly dose of sanity, the prevailing narrative, and this is an introduction to what I guess you could call a two-part episode, two separate chats, which I will be releasing as two separate episodes, but I think they go together, pair together very nicely, and this will be the intro to both of them. So if you're listening to one, please go ahead and listen to the other. One is a discussion with Atlantic writer Connor Friedersdorf. His recent piece in The Atlantic, "The DEI Industry Needs to Check His Privilege." Obviously, the discussion, the topic is diversity, equity, and inclusion. The other episode and chat will be... with Haley Kennington. She writes on the Wrong Speak Publishing Substack, and she had a great piece recently, Corporate Blackmail, ESG and the Woke Social Credit Score System. ESG is something that's been in the news and in the online discussion quite a bit recently. And so why I think these two issues go together so well, or unfortunately well, is they both are indicative of two unfortunate dynamics in modern American life. One is the over-bureaucratization of everything, and two is the use of benign or admirable or honorable language to mask and hide and launder more nefarious and counterproductive activities and programs, which is what I think is happening with both DEI and ESG. Okay, so DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Diversity has been around for a while, right? Or the notion that institutions, whether corporate America, hiring, college, anywhere where there's some sort of admissions process, that, you know, that whoever's doing the admitting should be on the lookout for diversity, right? That people, no matter their demographic category or their immutable characteristics, that their skills, abilities should be recognized and honored, and there should be a place for everybody there, and companies and schools should try to have diverse student bodies, diverse workforces. Obviously, there's some argument about what that means, but, you know, diversity, once again, been around for a minute or two. Equity and inclusion. Where did equity come from? It came out of nowhere. We used to talk about equality, and equality was not really something that was included in, you know, in corporate policy, in corporate governance policy, right? Or college governance policy. It was kind of like, hey, this is a principle. Everyone should be trying to do the right thing at all times. But in America, we're pretty soundly grounded in equality of opportunity, as opposed to equality of outcome. And we fought those battles over the course of the 20th century, contrasting our capitalist system with the communist egalitarian system and central planning system for many decades, and we see which one won out. And then this equality shifts to equity at lightning speed. And all of a sudden, who talked about equity other than as a description of owning, you know, having ownership in private enterprises or companies before about 2016-17? But all of a sudden, this is now part of a project and part of principles that are now supposed to govern nearly every major corporation and most non-major corporations in America, right? Equity is simply the whitewashing of equality of outcome. That's what it's there to drive forward, that we are supposed to try to find ways to make everything equal. An equality of results, and we all know that people have different skills, different talents, different abilities, and put in different efforts, and I don't know how equity got in there. Inclusion. I think also people are wondering what the hell is inclusion and what's it doing in there, and obviously people have a variety of takes on it and can sometimes explain it away as something just, you know, wanting to make everybody feel welcomed. Well, okay, is that necessarily part of the experience in the workforce or an employment situation or going to a school? Couldn't that be handled by just making sure people don't abuse each other or just operate with basic sense of decorum and respect for each other? But no, this now has to be essentially commodified and bureaucratized, right? It has to be something that a bureaucrat or an executive that you have to hire someone to implement. You can't just make sure that people are acting. You can't just have HR making sure that nobody's being abusive or violating company policy. You now have to have someone teaching everybody how to make everybody else feel included. And that's kind of childish, is it not? That really is a little bit more akin to something that you would hear about in elementary school, in kindergarten. Let's have little exercises teaching people how to treat each other. I mean, that's something you do with children. Once people get to the point of adulthood, you understand that they're going to have various missives, hostilities, that things get sloppy and interpersonal dynamics between people. And, you know, that a company is going to, is not always, not every company can be everything to everyone. Somewhat is going to be somewhat exclusionary, just like a hiring process is exclusionary. Everybody who's not up to the task, everybody who's not up to the qualifications is going to get excluded. So it's very strange that inclusion seems to now be a bureaucratically mandated principle of corporate America and also of American higher education. I mean, just looking at some of what is part of the inclusion prong of a diversity, equity, and inclusion program, a day of expression, that employers should have a day of expression so all their employees have an opportunity to express their passion for a social justice cause that is important to them. This is appropriate in the workplace. I mean, this is for children. No. This is not, I mean, listen, if there's a particular social justice movement that is specifically applicable or relevant to a company's business, then that's a different story. But that's not, those boundaries are not here. The rationale behind diversity, equity, and inclusion, once again, all three words together, uppercase bureaucratized, is that companies, every company needs to be having something like a day of expression so that everybody, all their employees can find a way to express themselves in their personal beliefs that have no business in the workplace, right? Other things that are part of DEI programs, unconscious bias training, have been proven many times over to have no impact whatsoever to, if anything, create more division within the workplace because everyone's just going to understand, well, like, hold on, wait a second, you know, I make observations just like anybody else and I try not to be prejudicial or racist based on people's immutable characteristics, but I don't need anybody at an advanced age, you know, once I'm an adult in the workforce to tell me how to treat people, you know, with a basic level of respect and humanity, right? Allyship training, what on earth is that supposed to mean? I think you get the picture here, but, you know, Connor's thesis in his piece on DEI is that, in saying that, and so one of the reasons why the bureaucratization of this is so insidious is that, do you know how much money is now being funneled through this? Do you know how many people are now employed to teach as executives or consultants in the world of diversity, equity, and inclusion to try to implement these programs in corporations? And you got to wonder, is that money being well spent? Are we wasting billions and billions of dollars on funding people who are already in the executive class and just paying diversity, equity, inclusion consultants and instructors $250,000 a year? Meanwhile, there are people who, you know, who are part of the groups that they're supposedly teaching these lessons for that are struggling in working class environments and need some assistance with their material conditions and their personal finances. Is our society really allocating funds correctly when we're paying all this money to DEI executives and really screwing over the working class? And that's Connor's thesis, and that's what he and I will discuss. Okay, so getting on to ESG, which I think once again is very much related, but there are some interesting differences. But an interesting parallel, much like with diversity, equity, and inclusion, the diversity piece you can kind of make a case for, right? It's been around for a while, and you could say, okay, you know something, this isn't just whistling Dixie. It's not just covering weirder attempts to create communalism and treat people like children. No, we really should have, at least as a principle, maybe not our number one principle, the desire to have a diverse workforce or a diverse community, right? That you could justify, certainly. Similarly, in environmental, social, and governance. Environmental is one that may be legitimate, right? We should be looking at corporate America that has an impact on the environment and trying to determine which ones have a heavier or more harmful environmental impact and judge. And there should be at least one piece that judges companies based on that. It should certainly not be the sole metric or the primary metric other than maybe for companies that are directly involved in natural resources or toxic waste and things like that. But environmental, yeah, sure, we should maybe be measuring that. That is a measure of ethics. Then social and governance. We start diving into things that are just so subjective. We're measuring the wrong things. It's why you'll see, as I'll describe in a minute, you've got companies that are literally putting out products that are killing people that get higher ESG scores as other companies that don't kill people just because they have a more diverse workforce. An outside organization based purely on a score, judging whether or not they treat their employees well by, you know, whether or not they give away gym memberships or give away free lunch or have a foosball table in the office. I mean, these things are incredibly hard to quantify. quantify. But taking something that we can quantify a little bit better, like environmental scores or environmental impact, and lumping it in with social and governance, we've scrambled the whole thing. Just like with diversity, equity, and inclusion, by adding the EI to the D, we screwed it all up. And just like adding the SG to the E, we've screwed it all up. And to that point, and why I think that's the case, another piece from a former guest of mine, Aaron Sabarium, recently wrote in the Washington Free Beacon, how tobacco companies are crushing ESG ratings. Tobacco companies are crushing ESG ratings. Philip Morris, all these companies, either cigarette companies or oil companies, are doing really well in ESG ratings. So if this is the case, if ESG ratings are supposed to measure social credit or measure ethics or measure the magnanimity or how good a company is from a moral or values perspective, maybe the measurement system is off. Maybe the measurement system is off when Philip Morris gets an ESG score that's 37 points higher than Tesla. I mean, Tesla is taking so many gas-guzzling cars off the street, but because it doesn't participate in enough kind of peripheral outside diversity programs or doesn't have enough female executives, it has a much lower ESG score than Philip Morris. Do you not see what's off here? Okay, so in my chat with Haley Kennington, ESG scores a lot underlying that. I mean, that is not the last of the alphabet soup. You've also got CEI, which is kind of a subcategory of ESG. I mean, also, I think a lot of people have gone where I disagree with Haley, as you'll see in our conversation, but I think she comes around to agreeing with me a little bit, is that you cannot explain the entirety of corporations embracing social justice or progressive values just by ESG, with BlackRock and Vanguard and a couple of the big hedge funds and index funds pushing ESG scores, right? They're not the only investors in town, right? I mean, most companies, most corporations do not have BlackRock as an investor. They do not invest and hold a 6% stake in every publicly traded company on the face of the planet, right? So clearly there are a lot of companies, there are a lot of public corporations that are doing stuff in the DEI, ESG world or embracing social justice in a manner for reasons beyond just wanting BlackRock and Vanguard to reflect favorably upon them. And there's a lot of companies with ESG scores that are low that do incredibly well in the public markets, have shown great stock performance for Tesla, for instance. So I don't think it's such a one-to-one relationship between companies doing all this woke engaging in all this woke idiocy and wanting to have ESG scores that are high. I think it's also, it's kind of combined with some of those incentives from the private investor community and the banks, combined with the current makeup of their mid-level executive class, as I've talked about a lot of times. But nevertheless, ESG, once again, a corrupt and useless measurement of corporate ethics, environmental, which is what it was originally about. Okay, once again, I think you could find some justification and plausibility for that. But trying to throw in these completely subjective social and governance scores, which are mostly given out by these NGOs and these quasi-governmental groups that really have no credibility at all. They're stacked with former members of Democratic administrations, whether it be Obama or Joe Biden or whatnot. They don't have any semblance of a neutrality. They're there to push a particular political agenda. And really, not that the political agenda is wrong just because it's Democratic, but I'm sorry, it should not be either of the two parties that get to push their political agenda through these kind of, you know, corporate ethics blackmail scores like ESG. So once again, diversity, equity, inclusion chat with Connor Friedersdorf, environmental, social, and governance, ESG chat with Haley Kennington, whichever one you're listening to right now. Once you finish that one up, please go check out the other one. Think the two issues are super interesting together. In our continued study of corporate wokery, why corporations, historically motivated strictly by profit motive and generally reflecting conservative values, have taken an abrupt turn over the past decade embracing social progressive causes. Today we look at ESG scores. ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance, ostensibly a measurement of corporate ethics, but appears to have developed into something far more pernicious. With us today is journalist Haley Kennington to discuss a recent piece, Corporate Blackmail, ESG and the Woke Social Credit Score System. Haley, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Matt. Appreciate it.
For sure. So let's start at the top. The notion of a social credit score, that's generally in common parlance and discourse applied to individuals. And I guess ESG scores would be one of the various offshoots of social credit scores for corporations. But maybe you can give us a little overview on the notion of social credit scores and its how it's being practically applied, you know, in some say in the United States, but mostly in China and some other foreign nations.
Yeah, well, so yeah, most people are probably familiar with it from hearing, you know, China has already implemented that. I think it's probably going to come here quicker than we realize. And honestly, this is a good way to bring this in and to sort of break it in slowly to Americans. But in this case, ESG, you know, this is a more of a corporate credit score. And it's sort of split up to, you know, environmental, social, and governance, or corporate governance. But I think, you know, the biggest part of it is that with corporations, none of them, some may focus on the environmental side of it. So that might be climate, you know, climate change and gas emissions and things like that. But the social side of it, I think, is where things get a little hairy. You know, they're able to apply different, whatever that might mean for them, right? So whatever they think is morally ethical, maybe what they want to push. And that's sort of what my piece focuses on, is the LGBTQ push that we've seen in the last several years. I think it's sort of been a big thing recently. So it's more of almost like a trend, you know, and I think they'll probably fall out of this because we're seeing a lot of backlash from, you know, consumers who aren't interested in that kind of thing. So corporations, you know, but with them, it's more about the investors. They're not doing any of the social stuff that they are pushing for the consumer base or even their own base. This is more about, you know, pleasing the investors and their bottom line.
Well, and so these ESG scores, we'll get some more specifics about what they actually are in just a moment, but they're supposed to measure generally, and they originated strictly around environmental concerns. So a corporation's and their business's environmental impact, social and governance on how well workers are treated, and whether or not a company gives back to the community, its charitable endeavors, and how the companies govern themselves. But as you mentioned, in particular with the LGBTQ initiatives, it's kind of odd what portion, you know, how significant a share of the ESG initiatives are focused on that one particular issue, and is one of the many indicators of how, you know, ESG seems to have strayed from its initial initial objectives, or is at least measuring metrics that really have no relevance to the business or relevance to actual environmental, social, or governance concerns. Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the organizations that are behind ESG scores? And some of them that I've seen are the Human Rights Campaign, the United Nations. A lot of these organizations are where the ESG criteria and instructions seem to emanate from.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting, actually, because it's not just from one place. Some of these places can self-report. Yeah, some can self-report. So there's not like, yes, there's the main ESG that's sort of based around, CEI score, that's Human Rights Campaign.
CEI is the Corporate Equality Index, which I guess is a subcategory of ESG.
Right. So that's the Human Rights Campaign's sort of, I've say in my piece, you know, it's like the baby brother to the ESG. Mm-hmm. That's their scoring system. But there are others. You know, like I said, some can self-report. There's people that are wanting to implement just a centralized where, you know, you report into this one system and they'll run it. So point being, the scores can be all over the place. Sometimes it's 100% that you're trying to aim for. Sometimes it's a 20%, you know, point system. So it depends on the corporations and who we're talking about.
So there's a number of different measurement systems. They seem ESG seems to all follow a similar trajectory that a bunch of, you know, whether it's the UN or kind of another quasi-governmental NGO like the Human Rights Campaign, they kind of put something out there into the universe, some sort of charter or state mission statement, and then a bunch of corporations go sign on to that charter or mission statement, and then commit to advancing the cause, whatever cause is behind that charter mission statement.
Right.
Then they commit to establishing metrics, which are then used to monitor progress. And then those metrics, the ESG score, I guess, could be the ESG score and various ESG scores, subscores like the Long-Term Care Equality Index or the Gender Equality Index, are then used as the measurement tools for this stuff. I mean, could you tell us a little bit more about how the scores are conceived of and how they're measured?
Well, that's a good question. Again, when I started this, I had no idea that it was going to branch off into this huge web with all these different data points and all these different, like, it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So I'll focus on the Human Rights Campaign. With it, Yes, they've got the their CEI. They've got the LEI, like you said. There's one for cities. There's one for retirement homes is the LEI one. There's mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it breaks up to where it's schools. It's, and actually, when I was researching this, I found out there's something called welcoming schools that mm-hmm. I'd never heard of, but it's been implemented for, I think, a little bit over a decade now. Mm-hmm. So with each of these, they have different standards, and they have different, you know, one might be how you treat, you know, your employees, or how many, as far as like DEI scores, another acronym.
Vern, you know, I've seen criteria from whether or not you allow workers to be unionized.
Right.
Let's just back up once again on the, this all started environmentally. Originally it was really just E, right? Mm-hmm. Because you could figure that environmental impact is something that's somewhat tangible and measurable. Sure. And for corporations are in the business of producing things, and production has environmental impacts. And for a long time now, people have been focused on measuring which companies are treating the environment or are acting ethically in terms of their impact on the environment, right? So, for instance, you know, are you dumping toxic waste? Are you mm-hmm. cutting down too many trees? Do you have a high carbon footprint? You know, you could say, have your different opinions on whether or not, you know, what should be the measurement criteria for, you know, what is good and what is bad, or what is something that we can stomach and what's something we can't. However, there was pretty clearly a link and a connection between the things being measured and the ultimate objective. On the social and governance prongs of this, I mean, it seems like what's being used for judging whether or not a company scores high on and criteria for you know, social impact and quality governance, I mean, seem completely off the rails. I mean, that's where we get into a lot of the LGBTQ policies and whether or not you're providing certain benefits for LGBTQ partners, whether or not you're providing certain health care in terms of gender dysphoria, things of that nature. And then obviously the gender equality index, I mean, seems very straightforward, and pretty much, you know, you're judging a corporation just based on whether or not they hire lots of women, or hire lots of women for executive positions, or have any women on the board. And you start wondering whether or not the criteria, you know, what is being measured is really indicative of the health of an organization and their social impact. Would that be correct?
I would think so. Yeah. And what's weird about it is that these are all just moral things. So who decides what is the moral, you know, center for that? Like if it's to me, it's more of this virtue signaling, you know, they want to, and for investors too, this is their way of saying, look, I'm doing something good. I'm going to put my money behind this, you know, and this is a good cause, which, to your point, yes, environmental, I think most people could get behind, and that's something that's at least measurable. Mm-hmm. But with this, you know, they sort of set the standards where they want, and it's mm-hmm. up to these corporations to either fall in line. And what's bad about it is a lot of these, you know, they get deductions if they don't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, if they don't fall in line with certain...
when you say deductions from their score.
Yes, sorry, deductions from their score. And like I said, there's different scoring systems, so it depends on what we're talking about. But for a mm-hmm. lot of them, you know, if they aren't fully in line with the credit scoring system, then they can dock points. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not what investors want. Investors aren't going to, like, I think, was it Tesla that was in the top three or the top five last year in environmental, as mm-hmm. far as the ESG scores go, but he failed on social and governance.
That's interesting that you mentioned Tesla, because it was that was highlighted in another piece on this topic today, written by another writer that I'm a big fan of, who's been on here a couple times, named Aaron Sabarium. And he was contrasting how Tesla's ESG scores with the ESG scores of tobacco companies. And it's just incredible. If you wanted to give the example, the case study on what a fraud ESG is, on how it's not measuring actual impact and harmful effects, and just based on these kind of these kind of diversity identity based signals, and this piece would really do it. It's in the Washington Free Beacon. It was called "How Tobacco Companies Are Crushing ESG Ratings." Essentially, it contrasted the ESG ratings of Philip Morris, which were very high, with Tesla, which are very low. And then you're looking at this and figuring, well, wait a second, cigarettes are literally killing people. Right. I mean, it might be the consumer product that kills more people than anything else. And it's getting seemingly off the hook because they engage in all this hollow pageantry around around gender equality. It's that they got a higher Philip Morris got a higher ESG score than Tesla because they have more female executives. So it's I guess it's better that you're putting out a product that's giving people lung cancer as long as it's female executives who are doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild. That's what I mean. Like, so it's so all over the place, you know, and I don't know. It really, I don't know how much longer it's going to last, really, because I think a lot of this is getting a lot of pushback, you know, and I think with, you know, that's a really good example, actually. You would think, you know, that obviously Tesla is better for the environment because of their, you know, their vehicles. But I don't know. It just seems to me like this is a lot of virtue signaling. And it makes me wonder, it's such a small percentage of the population that in this particular case with the LGBTQ, it's such a small percentage of people. I can't imagine those people being able to pull the weight. Like if everybody drops back, you know, certainly there's not going to be enough people that are going to be able to buy the product to keep this afloat. I mean, I feel like it's a trend, right? Like then what is the next trend that they're going to go on to?
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
And we'll have more of The Prevailing Narrative after the break. I hesitate in wondering, okay, wait a second, in trying to establish causality of why have corporations adopted so many progressive liberal causes over the past decade.
Right.
I hesitate to put too much on ESG and DEI. And I factor this, or at least that the financial consequences or the fact that, you know, a BlackRock or a Goldman Sachs might be pushing some of this stuff, I think is one factor. But I hesitate to ascribe everything to it because these companies themselves don't seem that committed to it. Like you'll hear right. A Larry Fink of BlackRock. There was a video by Larry Fink. He was the CEO of BlackRock, and it's from 2017 even. And you know, he mentions that we're going to force behavior to increase diversity. Essentially, that you know, BlackRock is going to exert its financial leverage as an investor, as an activist shareholder, in order to motivate and incentivize portfolio companies, even non-portfolio companies. To essentially take action that would be in line with ESG standards, and one of those is clearly diversity. However, that's not the, you know, having BlackRock as an investor is not the only financial metric a corporation is looking for, right? I mean, if you go and look at, you know, some of the recent goings on with Bud Light and Target and whatnot, if your earnings drop, you know, you could be financially incentivized to want to placate large institutional shareholders like a BlackRock, but you're also, at the end of the day, you got to sell stuff to people, right? So if you're doing things that work against those purposes, you may be, the idea that these are all rational economic and financial decisions really start, that's unsupported, because these corporations may want, you know, they may be incentivized on the one hand to placate a BlackRock or a Vanguard or a State Street or the other big institutional investors, but those aren't their only investors, right? You're going, if you have a negative impact to your bottom line, it's not going to matter that, you know, you might get that the BlackRock CEO might pay lip service, or they might send out a press release talking about how proud they are of your diversity numbers. You know, this is all, I guess my point being, this is all a mishmash of motives, rationales, incentives, disincentives, and whatnot. So when people say that the only reason that these corporations are acting in this manner is because of ESG, I hesitate to give it that much weight. It definitely seems to be a factor, not necessarily the factor. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And this is fairly new. I mean, ESG's it's been around for over a decade now, but really implemented, and we just started hearing about it a couple years ago. But yeah, I do agree with you, and that's why it leads me to, you know, as I'm digging through all this stuff, and I found out, okay, well, it's the WEF, it's the UN. So then when you start looking into what their, you know, long-term goals are and stuff, for me, it starts to make a little bit more sense, because as far as the dollar, you know, and where that stands right now, I don't know if this is just like a long term way of crashing our dollar, or if this is a way. I don't see a way that this is ever going to be sustained, because there is no The metrics because it does seem
to work against your baseline financial concerns.
Sure.
Which is why I postulate that this is really a corporate culture item. And this is really not entirely, but a big portion of this is just being driven by the nature of the people who now work at these companies. That 30 years ago, the people that worked at these companies, even if they came with fancy Ivy League degrees or other recent degrees, and you know, someone who just got a marketing degree from whether it be an Ivy League school or a school like Vanderbilt or Emory or George Washington or Wisconsin or God knows what, while their education might have been a little more liberal, they weren't so dedicated to these social causes. So you have people working at these, and I think we saw this, everybody saw this with Anheuser-Busch and Bud Light, when the woman who was behind the Dylan Mulvaney trans collaboration campaign, you saw that this is the type of person who used to not work at these companies. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is a person who thinks that it's her corporate and social imperative that there's now a values based necessity for her as a corporate marketer, someone who gets to make marketing decisions for a company, to go ahead and try to alter, you know, the society and drive us to more acceptance of various subgroups and whatnot and get involved in these social causes. So, I mean, I think that if we were looking at what the motives are of a company to adopt some of this stuff, sure, one of it is to just placate ESG and the ESG scores. But hey, if you get a 78 ESG score instead of a 98, I don't think anyone's too concerned about that. I mean, maybe some people are concerned about whether or not they're getting a 98 or an 18, right?
Right.
So I think it's being driven culturally by a lot of true believers internally at the company. But when you marry that with the incentives from the financial system and the ESG scores and some of these big, you know, these companies that these organizations that are pseudo-governmental like the World Economic Forum, you know, then you really have a recipe for disaster, which is what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And, you know, it's funny because you hear the saying, go woke, go broke, but it's mm-hmm. almost the opposite with this. You know, if you don't, you know, if you don't buy into all this and play along, then it's not good for you. And that's what's so strange about it, because it's sort of taking all of these different things and just putting it down to one number. So that's what they look for, you know, and you're aiming for that. But I mean, the consumer themselves, I don't care. I mean, yes, you're going to put your money where you feel like your morals and your values align with the company. But mm-hmm. when the companies that you trust and love and have known for all these years, then when this is the game that they're playing and all of a sudden, you know, they're selling their souls basically to try to keep up with this credit score. I mean, where does that mm-hmm. lead?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's something else that a lot of parents, well, you're seeing it right now, that a lot of parents that want to be that don't want to take an active stand against Pride Month or the gay community and don't really would be more than happy to allow the gay community to do whatever they would like and, you know, to let them live their lives unobstructed, then have to see this put right in the face of their consumer decisions. And whether we like it or not, you know, the brands that you've dedicated your buying power to, you do want to feel good about. And these parents are kind of at odds internally and not wanting to go and be labeled someone or even really, you know, actively opposed necessarily the gay community. Sure. But when these consumer brands nobody wants to go switch brands. Nobody wants to go after to adopt a new consumer behavior. If you find a store that you're comfortable with, a brand that you're comfortable with, you want to stick with them. Now they're starting to see some stuff that's becoming uncomfortable for them. And it's, you know, creating a real tension in that consumer relationship.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's what I mean. Like, where do you go from there? To your point, you don't want to go out and try to find your favorite shirts and your favorite, all of these things take time. But yeah, and it makes me wonder, because if I just can't see how that would be worth it. I see on their end, but it seems like with all the money that they're going to be losing, and you can take Anheuser-Busch as a perfect example, you know, and what did they do when they realized that their stocks are crashing and stuff? They came out and they tried to blame it on like the PR people, and they fired a couple of different, which happened to be female, you know, and did these things, but they totally didn't. They took zero blame for their decisions. Yeah. We're like, oh, they did it. And then they were like, okay, that didn't work. So let's switch this up a little bit and change the story again. But, you know, I don't know that they'll be able to bounce back. But, you know, people's memories are so short. Maybe in a few years, people will forgive and they'll buy it again. I know they're going to be putting out a bunch of new, you know, more more of their usual, you know, the things that you're used to seeing as far as advertising.
Yes, that they're, I mean, and we saw, I think, today's Starbucks, at least the reports are that Starbucks has removed all Pride Month paraphernalia from stores.
Yeah, I saw that.
And the question being, in trying to tie, you know, and tying this back to ESG scores, right, is that, okay, let's say that this happened, right? Because it ESG scores, and correct me if I'm wrong, don't necessarily seem to be tied to, do I include these groups in my marketing campaigns, right? Because that was one of the other oddities. Like ESG scores, you know, might be based on internal policies, diversity numbers, as we've noted internally, you know, on anything that has a health impact, and you can judge that and measure it. But there wasn't, I'm not seeing anything in any of the ESG criteria that said that measures whether or not you have a marketing campaign around Pride Month, right? Or at least that doesn't
seem
to be.
Yeah, I didn't. If anything, these are like extra points, right? These are like flex points for a couple of companies maybe that don't hit the bar on a couple of other areas with ESG. Maybe this is a way for them to boost their score up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could be. It could be. So, I mean, I'm sure you've done some research on BlackRock. My view of it, they are a very powerful investor, but they are certainly not all consuming, right? You know, hey, if someone might turn up, BlackRock has been able to flex their corporate power on ESG. I think they got home, you know, isn't there a 6.8% owner of Home Depot, and they caused an internal controversy for Home Depot on releasing of a diversity report. Actually UPS, Abbott Labs, a couple other companies where BlackRock has been a big institutional investor with a big stake in the company and has flexed some of their muscle to force the companies into aligning with ESG principles. But hey, they don't own a big share of every company. Interesting with BlackRock, as I mentioned before, you know, there was this clip circulating around the internet recently, their CEO Larry Fink making some pretty bold claims about how they were going to utilize ESG to force companies to engage, you know, essentially indulge certain progressive social causes. And that obviously caused a bit of a fuss on the internet. And then I think it's interesting to look at their response, and their response in a publicly released was, this nearly 6-year-old clip misconstruing Larry's words about BlackRock's own approach to its employees has been circulating for years on social media and is often taken out of context. As a fiduciary, BlackRock's actions serve one purpose, maximizing long-term financial value for our clients. As an employer, BlackRock seeks to hire employees from a wide range of backgrounds and perspectives because we believe this diversity is critical to delivering for our clients in a rapidly changing world. So it looks like when put to task, when they are asked to comment on this, and when something is stirred up around, you know, their participation in ESG, and they want to walk that back. They want to say, hey, you know, we're just a financial firm. We're operating to maximize shareholder value. We're not trying to bully any companies and trying to use these scores as essentially blackmail to get them to change their policies. We just were talking about how we want to have a diverse workforce itself. I mean, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, if they're the ones that are making the rules, basically, I mean, if they're trying to maintain the ESG score, I think they're going to do whatever they need to make it, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't trust that at all. I think this has sort of just come off skewed from what it may have started as. And when you've got these people that have come in, and instead of pushing for these environmental concerns or even governance, you could probably get on board with to a degree. This is like their way of hyper virtue signaling how morally great they are to other people. And then so investors want to get on board with that for the same reasons. You know, they see an opportunity to say, okay, yeah, you know, and slide their money to where, I don't know, it's like a feather in their hat sort of thing. But
yep. But interesting that they do. Once again, you know, and looking at what the backlash is here, as these companies are taken to task, and, you know, and analyzing, do you go broke if you go woke? And it seemingly hasn't been the case over the last 5-6 years, because it seems like consumers have it took them a minute to catch on. And once, you know, now there's been a cascade of controversies, and once that happens, it's tough to stop. But maybe now that some you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, and there's been more visibility on some of these ESG and DEI initiatives and campaigns that, you know, that these corporations are going to start taking a step back from it. And looking once again at where all this stuff emanates from, because it doesn't emanate from the banks and the companies and the corporations. It seems to emanate from the UN and other governmental and quasi-governmental organizations that, you know, essentially want to hold themselves out as humanitarian organizations, as social justice organizations, and then seem to want to get themselves mixed up in corporate America. One of those is the Human Rights Campaign, and you wrote about them a bit in your piece, and mentioning that, you know, their current president, Kelly Robinson, you track her background. She was an organizer for Barack Obama, then an executive at Planned Parenthood. Very, very, you know, bluntly boasts of herself as a black queer woman. The chief of staff, Joni Madison, makes no bones about them trying to establish the standards and guidelines for corporate conduct. Interesting how this stuff, how these organizations that are clearly staffed by progressive activists are now making the rules that corporations seemingly think they have to abide by. You could tell us a little bit more about the Human Rights Campaign.
Yeah, I did find that very interesting. Not surprising, though. The more I looked at her, and she, you know, she sort of ticked all the boxes for the person that you would probably want to call, you know, be the president of the Human Rights Campaign. But yeah, they've got their hands in a little bit of everything. It's kind of scary, really, because it is an activist movement before anything else. You know, it is. Everyone deserves human rights. I don't think anybody would argue that. I don't think that anyone feels that it's even off kilter for that matter. But yeah, I mean, if she started as an activist, you know, and it's interesting to see that now that she's in a position where, I mean, to me, more than anything, that's what the entire human rights campaign is. But that now that they have their sort of tentacles and everything there, it's not just about one particular movement, even for that matter. It is all progressive ideas and it is all progressive moves. But with school and the medical community and even the retirement community, that's the one that sort of shocked me, like, you know, gosh. And then their scoring system.
What did you see in the retirement community?
Well, so it's basically the same thing you would put they have for schools or you know, so a diverse, you know, workforce and also, you know, equal rights and representation. Like if you don't have a certain number of, you know, gay people or if you don't have a certain number of rooms.
Like an old folk at a retirement community or hospice care. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I thought, wow. And, you know, they have a search engine on their website too, where you can go in and see which, you know, where these places are in which states, but every year they're adding on new facilities and that, you know, also medical, of course, too, but, you know, and it, when you have a patient that comes into the emergency room that may be having a heart problem and you've got to sit there and fiddle with whether or not this person is a male or a female before you can even start, you know, because it's different. You do different things depending on what they are. You know, it's potentially a life altering problem to sit there and wonder about things like that. So it's just really strange to watch because I feel like this stuff was not a big deal X amount of years ago. And it seems like this huge rush for it. But yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of everywhere with the Human Rights Campaign and what they're doing. And their scores are basically the same thing as far as just having, you know, representation and a certain number of these people who fall into different categories that they have set up. But
I'm looking at some of their activity here, and apparently, you know, there was a big impact on Johns Hopkins Medicine, and you know, they got docked big time on their HEI and ESG scores, 25 points in 2018, when they believed there were a couple of faculty members that mentioned, you know, that there were that there's evidence supporting that a lot of people of the LGBTQ community that their sexual orientation or their gender identity might have been caused by sexual abuse during childhood, even though you see that there's a significant correlation between those who have been report childhood sexual abuse and those who end up not being straight. And so they're clearly flexing their muscle there.
Yeah, and this is just their opinion. I mean, that's not something that the entire place should have been docked for, but
they'll come after you if you let anyone at your organization even publish something that runs against their orthodoxies.
Yep.
And we'll have more of the prevailing narrative after the break. Here's another interesting, it's that seemingly in all these initiatives, once again, I said this at the outset of the conversation, there seems to be this pattern where somebody puts out a charter, mission statement, set of principles, guidelines, whatnot, and then a bunch of other participants or corporations or medical facilities then actively join it. They sign on saying, yes, we are pledging our oath to honor these principles. I mean, for instance, that HEI score and an initiative that I just mentioned that got Johns Hopkins in trouble. Apparently they have 906 active participants within the medical field. UN Human Rights Campaign. I mean, they have a bunch of corporations actively. So these corporations very much, you know, they very often actively sign on to these things.
Yeah, they do. And that's what's scary, because there's more every year that are adding on, because I mean, it's a competition, you know, you don't want to be left in the dust. So either you play along and you jump through the hoops that they're asking you to jump through, or you lose credit scores. And I mean, I don't know who exactly is looking for these specifically when they make these decisions, like whether or not these people have, I mean, besides investors, I'm just saying as consumers or as just a medical provider. But I guess they do.
Another organization that plays a big role in ESG, once again, it emanated from the United Nations. One of their committees, I guess, or one of their commissions or offices, is the Office for High Commissioner for Human Rights, that you mentioned in your piece, focuses on LGBTQ. It says the OHCHR promotes and monitors the implementation of human rights standards globally, including through mechanisms such as resolutions, treaties, bodies, and special rapporteurs. OHCHR is working to, quote unquote, repeal laws criminalizing persons, also works to protect people from violence and discrimination on grounds of their sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics. I mean, interesting and you know, admirable principles, but like, how does that apply to any number of corporations?
That's just it. I mean, and who, you know, with the different scoring systems, there's different numbers and different criteria for depending on who we're talking about. With this one in particular, it's more of like a, I mean, I guess they base it mainly on DEI scores too, but it's this focus all of a sudden with the LGBTQ community that's sort of alarming to me, because I don't feel like that was something that, number one, that represents a large number of people in the world, but the focus on that is sort of what drew my interest to it. That, and of course, the different corporate businesses that we've seen that who have signed on and have paid for it, with consumers not wanting to purchase their products. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's all sort of the same similar idea, but just different factions and different scoring systems, all of which sort of circle around the same things, you know, as far as social cues or social movements.
Actually, another one that is related to the UN and also the World Economic Forum, the PGLE. that would be the Partnership for Global LGBTQI Equality, has a partnership with the World Economic Forum. And they also seem quite involved in all of this. They mentioned that their goal is to work around the world, not only in sharing best practices, but also showing strength in numbers with a platform on the World Economic Forum, the power of the UN, and finally, the strength of companies working together. When you combine the corporate economies of these 14 countries that we're working with, we're bigger than a lot of countries. So we have tremendous power. It seems like these. And that's an interesting point,
right?
Because it seems like these organizations are trying to legislate, right?
Yeah.
They're trying to take on the role of legislatures and government policy and say, you know, historically and principally for the betterment of society and the welfare of the citizenry that are typically, you know, these are supposed to be passed by legislators.
Right.
But instead, we're going to go ahead and kind of create these monitoring systems and criteria and essentially you try to incentivize or disincentivize companies from engaging in this behavior, and nobody elected us. I mean, these are not legislators.
There you go.
They're not accountable to anybody, but they seem to be pretty transparent in that being their ultimate objective, to take on the role of legislators.
Yeah. And then I saw that with the Human Rights Campaign or even with PGLE, they meet at Davos, you know, with the World Economic Forum. They have like separate conferences and stuff every year with it. But yes, to your point, a lot of them are pretty open about it. Like, no, our main goal is to get policies put into place that, you know, benefit a certain, depending on what it is, mainly it's DEI and some of these, you know, other more social things that we're seeing, but these policies put in place on a state level, on a, you know, on a federal level that can change the fabric of what we call society. So yeah, it's pretty scary. And the fact that they're so heavily involved with some of the, you know, main players. And to me, that's the UN and the WEF. It's a really big deal to them. They have a huge interest in this. So it's, you know, to me, I try to look, you know, beyond that and what, why, and if it's all about just changing policy, it's not like you start taking your eye off the ball of what it started on and what's supposed to be important. And then it starts being like, okay, how, you know, these people are moving these things in a certain way because they want a certain outcome. So what are their goals?
Yeah, I mean, looking at their goals, I do mostly just chalk it up to misguided do-gooderism. I mean, you know, I'm looking at it, population control and interfering with fertility. Well, why would they want less people that who are they need more? You need to be above the economy benefits when you're above the replacement fertility rate, right? I mean, reducing the fertility rate serves very few is economically proficient for very few businesses. I mean, I just think it's a bunch of, you know, wealthy, out of touch people who just have bad ideas about society, and they think these bad ideas increase their credibility or make them good people who are fighting the causes of oppression and in the name of justice. And you compound, you add that's the jet fuel that you add to the fire of them having power, and then you get what's up in flames now.
You may be spot on with that. You know, to your point about the fertility and that kind of thing, you know, the UN and well, mainly the WEF, but with the Bill Gates Foundation and things like that, there are certain areas where they're overpopulated as far as Africa. And, you know, obviously, well, but there's implementations that they've put into place to try to lower that in some areas with, you know, as far as family planning and birth control and stuff like that. So, yes, I think that they do have an interest in that kind of thing, but you might be right. It may just be that they're so completely out of touch, and they think that this is their, like, their type of philanthropy that is morally.
Yeah, because that's what you're seeing with middle management, right? The Bud Light administrators, those middle manager marketers, they want to get, okay, great example. Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition.
Yes.
It's tougher to get because you now have to track magazine subscriptions versus digital downloads and digital views and whatnot. You know, it's harder to track what's success or failure for a magazine. But with the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition, you'd figure, okay, if less men want to buy it, it's going to be that's a negative indicator for how it's doing, right? And then you've got you know, they decide to go and put a transgender person in the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition, elderly woman with Martha Stewart, and she looks amazing for her age, but maybe. Maybe not, you know, Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition level. Put some plus size models in there. You're thinking, what could be motivating this?
Right.
Then you go to the Instagram page of the editor of the Swimsuit Edition, and you see that she's getting so many positive comments in her Instagram comment boxes. She's getting lauded and praised incessantly over what a freedom fighter she is, and, you know, how she's so brave to go see new forms of beauty and highlight and promote them in the Swimsuit Edition. And you're looking at that and you're thinking, okay, well, let's say that a Swimsuit Edition circulation went down 5-10%. She's going to sit there and still think she's doing a good job, right? Because she's got so many sycophants and other phonies, other virtue signalers.
Yep.
They're hopping in her social media, telling her what a great job she's doing, that she can then go ahead and kind of brush off the fact that the economic results, straight economic results for her decisions, aren't really that great. So I think it's all moral cover. It's all moral deflection.
Well, and we saw that with the Anheuser-Busch stuff too, right? She was the same kind of, you know, way where she thought that she was going to bring it back, which honestly, Bud Light at the time that she was brought on wasn't really doing that bad. They were about average where any other beer company was at the time. We just got over that one thing for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I mean, it's their opportunity, I guess, to virtue signal and to feel like they're doing something great for a small amount of people. But you're right. I mean, they do get the right pat on the back from what they're looking for, I guess. And it may cost them their job in the end, but...
Yeah, it's cost a couple people. I don't know. We're going to have to see if a handful of anvils coming down on some mid-level marketing executives who, you know, engage in these initiatives or you know, formulate these initiatives that get backlash, whether that's enough to scare off the rest of the industry, I think it's going to be a little bit more selective and slower moving there. So I'm not entirely optimistic. But hey, it is encouraging to at least see some backlash that's having some tangible results. And while you don't want to see anybody lose their job, I am sorry. You know, if you stray from the corporate principles, if you want to lecture, speak down, and scold a traditional customer base of a brand, you can't be surprised if that has negative career consequences for you. Haley wrote this piece, Corporate Blackmail, ESG, and the Woke Social Credit Score System. Haley, anything else from that piece that you think would be, you know, key to our understanding of ESG scores, how they've come about and what their impact are?
I just think it's definitely something to keep an eye on, because though it's been it's been around for a little while, I think the more and more corporations that realize that if they're going to be competitive at all, that they're going to have to play these games and try to fit into these, you know, little different criteria. It's going to be interesting to see how many will fight against it or will fall off and not, you know, be a part of the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think what is it? It's only about maybe 13, 14 years. Am I correct that it originated in 2009 with the UN Sustainable Development Goals?
Right.
That was
right.
The first
but
real
you didn't
ESG
really hear
scores.
About it much, though. Yeah, but as yeah. far as just hearing about it in mainstream, you know, nobody really heard much about it until around 2014 or so.
Yep.
And people
yep.
started sort of talking about it. But yeah, so I don't know. It's something to keep your eye on, because, you know, when you're seeing this influx of different things that you maybe didn't expect to see from, you know, X company, whichever is your favorite brand. Mm-hmm. It's something to remember that they're not, obviously they're not.
Yeah. I mean, when you're sitting there and trying to analyze if there's a brand that you like that seems to be engaging in campaigns that really have no relation to their business, that seem to be running against the values that they have traditionally, even very recently, seem to have championed and things of that nature, and wondering if there's something, I don't want to say sinister, because that's, once again, I think the people that make this monocausal, that say, hey, the only reason that these companies are engaging in these woke marketing campaigns is because of ESG scores, I think that's giving it a little bit too much credit. But this is definitely one of the factors that's kind of shifting the tides, that's guiding the boats in a different direction.
Well, and if we take Bud Light again as an example, that's one in a billion where this, you know, showed enough of an impact for them to go, whoa, okay, hold on. You know, it's so hard to get enough mm-hmm. people behind one. When I see these different boycotting campaigns, it sounds great, you know, but when you first started out, you were saying, you know, nobody really wants to change up these things that they've know and trust.
They want
to
switch their brands. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like a boycott might work for this one situation, but people, consumers and people just day to day a lot of people are just lazy. They don't want to take the extra time to try to do what they know is the right thing. It's easier just to go ahead and give them your money and keep it, you know. So what does that say about, you know, their goals as far as trying to kowtow to just a certain population? They don't care, because at the end of the day, I think a lot of people aren't going to continue to buy the product anyway. And even if they don't agree with, you know, what they're seeing, it's just, there's so many corporations that have signed on to the ESG and all the different ones that, you know, where do you draw the line? I mean, it's going to get to the point where there's, if you've got, I don't know if it's beer or if it's, you know, a clothing company where they're all signed on to this thing. Like North Face, that one sort of surprised me.
They've been doing this for a few years. North Face has had strange, just odd, peculiar, like, listen, you want to go put a, there are many very easy ways to acknowledge, Pride Month or to show some support for the gay community. I mean, the way that North Face has decided to do it, with putting really strange, peculiar, gender bending people very front and center and promoting their products. And I think it really, like, it took back a lot of people. But here's the thing. They obviously haven't seen enough negative impact on their business. They stopped doing it because this was not the first year.
Right.
They've done this for a few years now. So once again, the idea that this automatically triggers a backlash is a fallacy. It's only recently started to trigger backlash. We'll have to see if this cascade continues. But
right.
I think this is something that's been going on. It has been more prevalent than people have really noticed. It's been simmering under the surface and is now finally reaching general consciousness. But as you mentioned, something that we're definitely going to have to keep in mind as people, the business of America is business, and our consumer choices and the way that our corporations act is definitely a big part of our life, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. So this was a fantastic piece. Haley, maybe you could tell everybody where they can find you and your work on the internet.
I'm at wrongspeak.net. And you can also find me on Twitter at Lady Kennington, and there's a link tree there that you can follow to get more of my links. But yeah, I would check out Wrong Speak, and I really appreciate you having me on, Matt. Thank you.
My pleasure. And yes, ESG scores, everybody, it's been in the news a lot recently, been on everybody's mind. I hope that this was clarifying and understanding where it emanates from, what its actual impact is, and also that some people, just to caution some people in going a little too far in trying to ascribe this as the kind of univariate singular cause to everything that's going on right now. It's definitely a big cause, but be hesitant to describe it as the only one. But a very rich and confusing topic, because you start getting into connecting the dots here in the web and the various acronym organizations, and it gets a little cloudy. So I'm hoping we provided some clarity here today. Haley, thank you once again for joining us.
I am Matt Belinsky. Once again, you can listen and subscribe to The Prevailing Narrative on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening right now. Make sure to follow me on my socials at Matt Belinsky, MattBilinsky.
Thanks once again so much, everybody. This is The Prevailing Narrative.